here to join us in the first hour, surviving a massive earthquake in Japan that he has not even heard of. That shows you what our news. They love reporting fires and weather in Japan and, I'm sorry, and earthquakes. But then you live in the earthquake zone and you don't even know what happened. That kind of gives us a perspective on the priority of mainstream media. James Corbett is with us. Of course, he is the top-notch podcaster, investigative reporter extraordinaire at CorbettReport.com. If you're not going there every day, you should be. Bookmark that thing. He joins us the last Monday of every month here on the Jack Blood Show from Japan. Glad to have you as always, James Corbett. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Glad to be here, Jack. How are things in the U.S. of A today?
Yeah, I'm ready to be hit by one of these flying killer robots at this point. You know, we're told that our government can assassinate whoever they want. They've got a hit list. That shouldn't be a big surprise to people. They've been doing that for decades, but now they just openly talk about it. We're told that these flying robots are going to keep us safe, and they're constantly expanding the battlefields. In fact, right now, there is some kind of a bidding war from the states to get this kind of business, and we're not really that upset about it, apparently. Afghanistan is. How does that work out? And I'm glad you survived the non-earthquake.
Hadn't even heard about it, but there you go. I'm a few hundred miles away over here. But interesting stuff happening in Afghanistan, isn't it, right now? And just last Friday, in fact, the German defense minister, or Thomas de Maizière, which doesn't sound very German to me at all, but apparently he came out and said that the U.S. is thinking about leaving 8,000 to 12,000 troops in Afghanistan after 2014. So Iraq redux, we're pulling out, it's over, don't think about it or talk about it anymore, even no matter how many people we have there, no matter what kind of bases we've built there, or how the fact that we're going to occupy it into perpetuity. It doesn't matter, it's just don't talk about it anymore, and it won't exist. But no, they're not probably going to pull out at all in 2014. They're just going to make a show out of it. No matter what Karzai says or does, he's just putting up a show for the home crowd, as it were, because obviously he's having his strings pulled as he always has. So I think he's just putting on a show more than anything else.
Yeah, this whole thing could be made to order for our perusal, so that we have something to talk about. So that it's probably about money at some point here, or who gets a cut of what. Now, I heard that the numbers were 70,000 troops on the ground now in Afghanistan. They're going to remove 35,000, which is basically to erase this Obama surge, and they're going to be left with about 35,000 troops after 2014, James, that would actually be above where what Bush had in there before Obama came into office. Are my numbers wrong?
I have no idea. I'm just quoting what this German defense minister was saying. He was saying 8,000 to 12,000 troops after 2014. But then again, it's all in the definition of the troops and whether they're active, you know, forces, or whether they're contractors or what have you. They always have the ways of manipulating those numbers around anyway. So I don't think I'd trust any of the numbers that are floating around. But regardless, it'll be in the tens of thousands.
Karzai is ordering U.S. torture troops to leave. I'm sure you've seen this. There are U.S. special forces. I guess they've been torturing a lot of people, killing innocent people. I understand there's no one innocent in Afghanistan, that they're all terrorists. That's at least what we're told here. I'm sure they have to torture people in record numbers. But that appears to be the cataclysm here. And could it be that the people are finally just sick of it, and he's got to stay on the side of his people if he still wants to be in power in Kabul, not Afghanistan? He only rules Kabul, which is a very small part of Afghanistan. But could this just be political in nature, that it's good to saber rattle, it's good to threaten, it's good to, you know, have some harsh words for the United States? That makes you look better in the eyes of your people in Afghanistan.
Well, there's no doubt about Karzai and his links. I mean, he knows what side his bread is buttered on, and his brother was formerly one of the big drug dealers, famously one of the big drug dealers in Afghanistan before he got assassinated in some sort of deal that went wrong or something bizarre in that whole episode. So I hope people will look into that, his brother and what he was involved in with the CIA, by the way. But yeah, no, I think Karzai is definitely in the back pocket of the West generally, and he's not. I mean, he's just putting up a stink. I think that's all it is—just putting on a show and just playing to the home crowd a little bit. And I think that has to be done in this environment. And I think he knows what he's doing. I mean, he's managed to maintain that puppet position for years now, and no sign of letting up. So I think he's just going along to get along. And again, just this big show banning from Kabul of some American special ops forces is probably not going to have much of an effect on the mission overall. And who knows when or how or if this will even be implemented, because I'm assuming it'll just be on the say-so of the Americans. And I don't think that we can trust that as far as the American government can throw it.
Right. The U.S. torture troops aren't going to be leaving Afghanistan anytime soon, but let's just say they are. Let's just pretend they are. Let's just pretend the war is over. It's I guess that's how we roll in this world of illusion. Now, Karzai came from UNICAL. Do I have that right? I know he came from one of the oil companies, and that's how he got the job to be president of Kabul. It was UNICAL, right? Does he still work for the oil companies, in your opinion?
Well, I mean, not directly. He's not on the payroll per se, but once an operative, always an operative. Yeah, he was connected with UNICAL. I'd have to look it up so I describe the relationship properly. It's not on the tip of my tongue, but yes, absolutely. He was in bed with UNICAL in some way, shape, or form, and now has managed to maintain this puppet position for as long as it's been in existence. It's quite a political feat for someone who... Well, I don't think he enjoys the support of a large section of Afghan society, because, of course, Afghan is a pretty tribal place anyway. There's a lot of different factions there, and the fact that it's been held together by Karzai for so long is just a testament to the occupation that has been ongoing for the past, what is it now, we're into the 12th year? This is the longest U.S. Foreign combat operation in history? Am I incorrect about that?
No, it is. Yeah. You have to define occupation, right? Because we're still occupying South Korea. North Korea, or we're still occupying France in this capacity. And it's just amazing that he has lasted this long. Of course, you look at the death and the mayhem and the destruction, and people don't really see what happens on the ground, but a lot of hospitals ruined, people living in such abject poverty and surrounded by disease, and then being snatched and tortured or just drone striked by, accidental, death robots. You would think at some point the people would rise up there. There would be some kind of an Afghan spring, and they'd get rid of that guy, put in somebody else that can really get the job done and improve things, the conditions on the ground in Afghanistan. But that's yet to happen. I don't know what's wrong with the people in Afghanistan. Maybe they just like, maybe a lot of people like the United States there because they don't have to take responsibility. Is that, did I lose you, James?
Sorry about that. I would just say that absolutely. I think it's more a question of there not being an organized opposition to Karzai in the country generally. I mean, I think there are a lot of different factions that have their grievances against him, but I don't think that there's one that would be able to overpower that. And of course, with the US and NATO behind him. And it's funny. I mean, even the New York Times biography of Karzai, you can go and read it. It describes his presidency awash in American and NATO money. Mr. Karzai's government is widely regarded as one of the most corrupt in the world. So, yeah. Mission accomplished there, guys, I guess.
So I think I'm hearing you say that Revolution Incorporated worldwide has not approved revolution there, so there isn't one.
Yeah, bingo. Yeah. Sadly enough, I think that's pretty much the case. And there's a lot of history behind that as well that comes into play. But it's a horrific situation. And the thing is, I mean, ask the average American on the street now what in 2013 American troops are doing on the ground in Afghanistan. What is the point now, 12 years later? There's not even a fake justification. I mean, at least after 9/11 they had the excuse of 9/11 and Al-Qaeda and bin Laden and that whole myth. I mean, it was a myth, but at least they had a myth. At this point, there's nothing. There's absolutely nothing. And it's just ridiculous to think of people.
They're not defining it. They haven't put it out in an advertising package like the Bush administration did. They had 20 different excuses. And when one would burn out, they had the next one ready to go. The only thing I can contend here, if somebody is asking the question, is that we are afraid that the Taliban will take control of the government again. It will fall and we'll have to start all over. So basically,
the Taliban, you mean the guys that were originally the freedom fighters back in the 80s?
The guys that we flew out on C-130s before the war started to Pakistan. Yeah, those guys.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I see. How this works.
Them and we're afraid that they'll take over the government again. And this is, I think they're using it against the people of Afghanistan as well. Look, I mean, you want your girls not to be murdered if they're going to school, or you don't want this, all this crazy Sharia law, then let us just do what we're doing and we'll try to make sure that doesn't happen. And so I guess in some ways that does keep the people of Afghanistan passive in any kind of rising up against the forces. But at some point you just got to get sick of it. When you've seen enough of your relatives getting killed, you just got to get sick of it and go, all right, I'll take the Taliban. I'll take my chances with them. But as you mentioned, the whole game is pretty much rigged. How do you make Iraq out? And I hate to start early in the morning with all this geopolitical stuff, folks, but I got to ask James about it while I have him, because he's a smart guy and does the homework. This is something we're not hearing much here. It's really in the very back pages of the newspapers, but there are tons of attacks every day now. Car bombings, mosque bombings. The violence has really raged up in Iraq, if we're to believe what the media says. And it seems like sectarian violence all over again. Shia versus Sunni. Sunnis attacking and eradicating the Shia. Yet we're told that Iran, which is a Shia government, works with these Sunni terrorists all the time. But they seem to not be able to stand each other in Iraq. Now, to give people a view of history, we took out the Sunnis and put the Shias in power. We weren't supposed to be doing that, but that's what logically did happen. And now the Sunnis are fighting back. All this sectarian violence, what do you think? Is this P2OG again, or Gladio, a version of Gladio? Or are these people being spurred on to create this kind of order out of chaos situation and scenario to, I guess, justify keeping people in Iraq? Or is this coming all apart at the wheels again?
Well, you point out that this isn't on the in being covered in the news anymore. And I think that that from what we can take from that is the fact that Iraq was a success, mission accomplished. And for all intents and purposes, the U.S. is done its mission there, even regardless of how many troops are still on the ground, how many bases they still have, or how many contractors are still operating in the country. The purpose of what they were doing in Iraq was to break the country into the three parts, the Kurdistan, Sunni state, Shiite state. And they've pretty much managed to accomplish that. And now the sectarian violence that's going on there is just icing on the cake. I think the real, when we look at the grander geopolitical strategy in that region, what we're looking at is the setting apart of these different factions and setting them on each other. And they're definitely obviously looking for a bulwark against Iran from becoming the regional power that it would self-evidently be if it were just left to its own devices. And what's the best way to do that than to have this sectarian violence right on its doorstep, threatening to spill over the borders and with U.S. protected terrorist groups committing terrorist attacks in Iran, with groups like the MEK or whatever name they're going by these days. They have a million different names, but who are literally on formerly U.S. occupied bases, Camp Ashraf in southeast Iraq, on the border of Iran. And this is a group that has been listed by the U.S. State Department as a terror organization for decades, and they've just delisted them because they're doing the right kind of terrorism. They're terrorizing Iran, so that's all for the good. And I think this is ultimately the strategy of what was in play in Iraq. It was just simply to break it into these pieces, and once that it's broken and lying in pieces on the floor, I think there's no news story in that, because that's exactly what they wanted to have happen.
Right. They're not throwing flowers at our feet still. We're still waiting for that, and they can't get along. I mean, that's just the natural order of things. They're not in that headspace, and what's happened the last 10 or 15 years certainly hasn't helped that. In fact, they were pretty stable and very sophisticated. I'm not going to endorse bringing back, you know, Saddam Hussein here, but they had a pretty modern, sophisticated, and tolerant society under Hussein, who was able to keep his enemies in check, was able to defend against the Turkish invaders, which is now, talking about Kurdistan, is kind of what their daily life is, caught in between the rock and the hard place. Sorry for the pun. But it is something that you just can't fix, right? There is tribal violence. There are man against man. And then to, you know, further kind of put a shot of steroids into that, James, to keep the divide and rule moniker rolling. That's just what you do, right?
Well, you can't fix it because it was broken on purpose decades and in fact, a century ago, basically. I mean, in the wake of World War One was when the lines of the Middle East as we know it today were drawn on maps in the parlor rooms in Paris, thousands of miles away, for the pleasure of the ruling elite of that time. And of course, the Western powers that had just won the war, they were having their little game of imperial conquest, and they started drawing lines on a map in the Middle East all over the place and just arbitrarily creating the very types of states as we know them today. I mean, we talk about Iraq and Syria and places like this as if they have always been on the map, but they were, I mean, they were creations, imperial creations. And yes, they contain different groups, different sects, different tribes, different peoples with different histories that when they're put into these in completely made up concoctions known as the modern states, of course, there's going to be all of this type of fighting and violence and sectarian strife. And I think that this is kind of, again, this has been set up to specifically to do this. And it's no surprise that this is, of course, in the, you know, the oil rich section of the world and in a geostrategically placed section of the world that that just happens to be right, you know, right on the doorstep now of moving into China, which also is an extremely important part of the next step of this game. So it's just so important for the powers to control that area as they have had to control it for well over a century now. And just convenient that these states are basically things that were created by them in the first place.
You know, it does kind of remind me of what happened here in the last century with forced integration, you know, where you get two people of two completely different cultures that don't really like each other all that much and are not used to being friends, and forcing them to live and cohabitate together. You know, you're going to have problems, right? I mean, so we've seen that here. I hope we're getting through it. I hope we're rising above that. But then I look at the Obama administration, James, and I see how divisive they can be, always putting men against women, rich against poor, black against white, and so on down the line. So it kind of does remind me of that when we're talking about Iraq. And that really doesn't work, does it, anywhere in the world? When you put people together who aren't used to, who are so different from each other and have been made to fear each other generally, then they don't usually get along very good at first.
Well, when you put people into arbitrary political unions where they are supposed to all cooperate with the country's resources, etc., and they're just supposed to assume that this is the way of life. I mean, it's hard for, I think, people in countries like America to understand that type of violent change in lifestyles that have happened in the course of people who have lived through these transitions. I mean, it would be like if the U.S. lost some next, you know, the next big war of the great powers, and suddenly, you know, parts of Mexico were being carved out and put together with parts of Texas, and that was going to be a new country, and then parts of, you know, the Northeast there is going to be lumped together with parts of Eastern Canada. And I mean, if it was just sort of randomly done like that, there would be all sorts of strife and things. And that's in a relatively, I mean, where people are not haven't had that thousands of years of strife and history behind them. So you can imagine how much more amplified that is in that context. And again, this is a very, very, very old strategy. It's been known about for probably thousands of years when we look back at the dawning of civilization and how people have always been pitted against each other to keep them fighting each other instead of looking at the grander prize, as it were. And I think this doesn't speak badly about the nature of humans themselves so much as it does about the ways that powerful people know how to play on that psychology. And I think people can obviously work together and will come together eventually once they are allowed to do so in their own manner, in their own way. But as I say, when they're thrown into these arbitrary political unions and expected to just live together, I mean, it's designed to fail.
Yeah, right, exactly. Well, and because of this history, this last 100 years, and then the thousands of years of just, you know, and various religious prejudices and dogma, can you just walk away from it? What do you think would really happen? And this is what we all want. What is the only answer? Get out of there. Just divest our interest from that and let whatever happens happens. Because I think one of the main reasons we went in there and this is not something you're going to hear about in the mainstream media, is that we're really fighting a proxy war with China for resources, China among others. It's economic warfare. And I think that's why they don't want to leave. I mean, let's just cut to the chase here. They want to control the oil in that region by either keeping it in the ground or letting it go, affecting global monetary policies and oil prices. And they don't want China in there. So, I mean, what happens if you just walk out? The next thing, China's got their drones over there, and it's all happening all over again with China as the boss?
Well, that, I mean, that's the type of boogeyman nightmare that they want to play on to get the sort of good old boys to go along with this. I mean, they have different levels of propaganda for different sections of the public. And, you know, there's something that will always play well in sort of the good old boy networks is, well, you know, if we're not in there, it's going to be the Chinese. You don't want them to get their hands on that, do you? And I mean, in the great geopolitical game, I guess there's some sort of argument to be made there, except for the fact that China has historically not been a country that does occupy other countries militarily, and hasn't for thousands of years. So there's kind of that, as opposed to, you know, the U.S. and the NATO powers, who make that their sort of specialty, and they've been doing that for a very long time and quite effectively. So there's that, and you can point, for example, to what's happening in Africa and China's policy of attempting to work with states and use development funds instead of, you know, trying to occupy them with boots on the ground. But no, I mean, that's an argument that'll always play well with certain sections of the population. Yeah, if we're not there, then it's going to be the Chinese. And
well, that's the thing. We're not gearing up Afghanistan to fight against the Taliban. We're gearing them up. We're trying to train them to police themselves and defend against Chinese. Now, I'm not talking about an overall invasion, but them just coming along and starting to ingratiate themselves into the entire culture and the society. And then again, competing with us on the global resources front. That is certain. That's I mean, good old boy or not, that seems like a reality. And from the, I think, pretty honest assessments I've read about the situation, that's exactly what could happen. Now, if you were the people that, instead of torturing and killing and droning attacking the citizens of Afghanistan or Iraq or wherever the case may be in North Africa now, we find, and you're the one that's building hospitals, and you're the one that's, you know, giving them food, and you're the ones that's really making life just so much better for them, wouldn't they just pile onto your side? So, I mean, there is, I guess, a case for some kind of cultural or financial intervention to at least show them, look, we broke the dishes, we're going to clean up this mess, and we're here to help you. And then maybe you can propagandize against the Chinese on that level. Wouldn't that be cheaper? Wouldn't that be better? And wouldn't we have less people trying to kill us, or less terrorists out there, allegedly, if we were the good guys? How can we just get through this and just be the good guys? Is that even possible? Is that theory even valuable? Does it even hold water?
Well, it's the old Bill Hicks line about if they wanted to deliver food and aid and hospitals and education to the you know, the poor nations of the world, they could do so with all of the shock, awe, and effectiveness that they unleash their missile right. strikes on Baghdad or whatever. I mean, they can do the exact same thing with flowers instead of bombs, and they don't, and they never have, and I'm not expecting that to change anytime soon, because however much sense it makes to us looking from the outside of that ring of power, they're looking at it from the inside, and they're not concerned about ultimately, I don't think they're concerned in the least about what's best for the planet or for any individual people other than themselves. And to aggrandize their power, they right. have to perpetuate this system of control and to keep people in states of need. I mean, if people don't need the system in some way, then they lose a bit of their power. And the only way to keep people needing the system is to keep them in that state where they're always fighting for subsistence, basically, or fighting against the invading power, or fighting against each other, or fighting against whatever the next boogeyman might be. So I think that this is all part of a big strategy, and that's exactly why it's not going to change anytime soon.
Well, you got there, and that's where I was going to end up too. So you people can see our thought process for the last 20 plus minutes. I just remember the old Seinfeld episode, when nothing's working, just do the opposite. And the opposite would be to be the guys in the white hats, to actually help people, and then to gain the trust and the respect and the love from people around the world, to set an example. See, these are things that we can do. And as you mentioned, James, it would be cheaper. But that's exactly the point. the military-industrial complex, the new F-35s, the this, the that, the drone, new drones coming off the assembly line, and everything that's involved, and all the people that profit from something like this intervention, military interventions all over the world, growing constantly, they don't really want to see it the other way. They like it just how it is.
Unfortunately so, and I was just reading an article on StratRisks.com about seven nations that are greatly increasing the size and scope of their military at the moment, and right at the top of the list, of course, is China, which is greatly expanding its military spending in recent years, but secondly, surprisingly enough, Japan, which is actually undergoing changes right now, or at least being proposed to amend the way that the constitution of Japan itself is amended, so that the ruling party that just got into power here can start basically tearing apart the constitution and tearing apart all sorts of civil liberties, or whatever you want to call them, human rights, I suppose, but also significantly to change the constitution to allow Japan to have an active military force, an offensive military force, which of course it's forbidden to do right now. So there's a lot of huge interests at stake here, and we're seeing literally billions and billions of dollars being outlaid, especially in this part of the globe right now. So I think absolutely there's entire sectors, industries that rely on this, and they don't profit when people aren't dying, and that's a harsh reality. But it's exactly where we are, and again, it's all about the people at the very top of the system who truly don't care about anyone who's supposedly their countryman. This isn't about countries. This is ultimately about power.
Yeah, and it's not about money. It's ultimately about power, right? I mean, when you've got trillions of dollars in your bank account, it ceases to even become money anymore.
Money is power, basically. It's yeah. Leverage, and it's used to keep people fighting with each other again at the bottom levels of the system. The people who own the central banks and print the money, I mean, that obviously money has no meaning whatsoever to these people. It's simply just tokens that they use to play their little game and to keep us way squabbling keep with each other.
Yeah, way to keep score, yeah. as some fat cats actually say it. And it is an addiction, and it's something that is because there's sex inside sex, not folks, you have dirty minds. That's with a CT. There are groups within groups, which we're constantly trying to expose as secret societies and whatnot, military, security, industrial complex, that have to have a dangerous world to live in to keep in power. The second the world becomes peaceful, you see an entire shift, power shift, not just paradigm shift, but power shift. So this is, of course, people want to know why all this happens. This is one of the main reasons why. I think the point I wanted to make with you, James, is that it's not necessary. It just isn't, and we've dug ourselves a pretty nice grave here, but it'd be easy just to step away. Step away from the guns. Step away from the F-35s and step away from the drone programs. It would be easy to do that, and I think that Americans are constantly held into this fear syndrome that if we don't do what we're doing, I mean, because now what are you talking about? Cutting the growth of the military, not the military budget from what it was last year. It'll still grow tremendously. It just won't grow as much. And this is the manufactured crisis that we have here in America. I tried to talk to you about it last time, the sequestering of the budget, this, oh my God, we're not going to, I mean, literally, James, in this country, we're not going to have police. We're not going to have firemen. There is not going to be a way to go and get on an airplane because there's not going to be enough air traffic controllers. People aren't going to be getting food and assistance, and we're not going to be able to defend the country because they're slashing and cutting the military. Oh, my God, something must be done. So that's constantly over our heads. So they have to justify it. I want to talk about, kind of segue in this next segment into Gladio B. I know you talked about that with Sibel Edmonds on your podcast. I also want to talk about FISA and Echelon, Panopticon, which I think you spoke to the MI5 agent.
Annie Michon.
Yeah, I saw her picture there, and I just couldn't get the name, but she's great. So let's do that. I want to take a quick break. We're with James Corbett, thecorbettreport.com. It is excellent. Go check out his podcast, but we have him right now for the next half hour. Stay tuned. This is the Jack Blood Show. We'll be right back. Try to get out of geopolitics and talk about the security state. Stay with us.
Hey, Father Christian, with your high and mighty Aaron, you're Mr. Bleeding Heart, with more of your compassion. Your labors to the hurt, but can assuage contagion. Hey, man of science, with your perfect rules of measure, can you improve this place with the data that you gather? Hey, Mother Mercy, can your lives be improved forever? Is your fecundity a trample or a treasure? Did you see your children cry when you left them at the station? Hey, moral soldier, you've got righteous proclamations and precious souls to fuel your faulty conflagrations.
To save the world is almost always a false front to control it. Welcome back. You're listening to the Jack Blood Show. We're live this Monday, just starting out in complex and deep geopolitics here on Monday, the 25th day of the second month, 2013. James Corbett is with us on the broadcast today. He is the host of the Corbett Report. That is a great, great website where you can get James' podcast and all the information that he puts out. It's fantastic. You can take it to the bank. He does his homework, and I'm always happy to have him here with me. We do a piece on his podcast once a month as well, so it's a quid pro quo here. Glad to share the wealth of information that both of us are neck deep into, James, and good having you today.
Absolutely. Well, absolutely. It's great to be able to spread this because, again, there's not a lot of people who want to get into the nitty-gritty of these types of geopolitical subjects and other things that I know it's a bit of a head-scratcher, especially on a Monday morning, but, but we got to do it. Well, we got to get into this.
We don't do it very much is the thing. I mean, I'm talking about domestic policies. We're trying to point out the hypocrisy of our politicians and, you know, trying to get deep inside what's happening in our own country. So I don't spend a lot of time these days talking about what's going on in the world with geopolitics. So I'm glad to share that with you. That is at least until I can get William Engdahl back on the show, who does a great job on all of that too. Sybil Edmonds is such an amazing person at Boiling Frogs. I know you've done a lot of work with her over the years. She was the whistleblower from 9/11 that was gagged by John Ashcroft, allowed not to talk about what she saw and heard as a translator. And I think one of the most important whistleblowers we have. I wish more people would pay attention to that whistle she blows. But you did a piece on Gladio B. That is the extension of P2OG Operation Gladio. That is to pretend you're terrorists in order to catch the terrorists primarily and to use terror to control the people so that the people will need to be protected generally. What did you guys find in your video series as far as how it's being applied practically in today's modern world?
Well, it's more the latter than the former because they want to the extent that this ever gets out, they want people to believe that this is about catching the terrorists or something. They're infiltrating or whatever kind of cockamamie stories they put forward. But what Sybil has been laying out in the past few weeks is just this incredible tale of how it is not some sort of alliance of convenience. It's not some sort of attempt to infiltrate that goes bad with blowback or something of that sort. It's that these terror groups are not only just being fostered, but are actually literally being directed by NATO and the West, including the Pentagon, and have been so since since the inception of this dawn of the age of terror, and since the 1990s at the very least. And of course, this goes back further in time in a different context, in the original Operation Gladio context. And I don't remember if we discussed this on your program last month or not. I feel like I'm repeating myself, but I can go back through that, some of that if
well, no, not really. I mean, I don't believe we did, and not to the extent that I think people need to hear it. You know, first we have this P2OG, which is a very modern version. Well, it's 10 years old now. This was Donald Rumsfeld's plan to pretend they were terrorists to catch the terrorists. It is called the strategy of tension. I've talked about it on the show ad nauseum, really, James. I mean, the Salvador option, you know, again, in Iran-Contra, pretend you're narco-terrorists, pretend you're the bad guys so that people will need you and you could do what you got to do. The NATO option. And so we're kind of back, because it was Gladio, NATO, Salvador, and P2OG in that order. We're kind of back to this Gladio-NATO option. And it is important to talk about, because people say there is no such thing as false flag terror. You know, so we...
Gladio was a bit different, because it was never about catching terrorists or anything of that sort. It was the original cover story, at the very least, for what it was, and it quickly became something different. But the idea was supposedly this was going to be some sort of bulwark against some sort of communist invasion of Europe. Should that ever happen, they'd have these stay-behind units that could self-operationalize and would be able to fight a guerrilla war against the Soviet occupiers. And that was, at the very least, that was what this whole idea was supposedly about. But very quickly, it turned into this radicalization of these right-wing extremist groups in all of these various Western European countries. And these right-wing extremists and nationalists got their hands on all sorts of NATO stockpiles of cash and weapons and training and other such things, and they started to commit terror attacks and blame them on the left side of that political spectrum in a lot of different countries, perhaps most famously in Italy. So that was the original idea of what that was supposedly about. But as Sabella's been pointing out, everyone so far who is, not many people really talk about Gladio at all, but to the extent that people do, they're always talking about sort of Western Europe, what was happening in Italy, but no one was talking about what happened in Turkey, which again, for decades, followed very much the same plan, radicalizing right-wing nationalists and helping them to commit these spectacular attacks and things and assassinations and things like that. But she's talking now about Gladio B, which is the transition from that old style, funding the right-wing nationalists and the extremists. And suddenly it's becoming about Islamization and funding Islamic groups and mosques and things of this sort, and how it's transitioned into that right in time for this war on terror age that we're living through right now. And she's talking about the people, the dates, the names. It's bewildering, the facts that she's throwing out on the table. And I'm actually stupefied that more people haven't picked up on this. I mean, this is, to my mind, the most explosive insider whistleblowing information that we've heard in years that I can think about. And I'm not just saying that because it was on my program. I'm saying that because this is an just incredible amount of facts and data. And I actually feel a bit gun-shy about talking about it because I don't want to screw it up. She talks about so much in so much detail with all of these people. And it is bewildering to a lot of people because they haven't been following that specific context, talking about Turkey and Azerbaijan and places like this. I mean, who knows about that? But it goes right into the heart of it. And she's talking about people like Al-Qaeda number one, the new number one, Ayman al-Zawahiri, who stepped in the wake of the bin Laden character being written out of the play, and how he was literally meeting with U.S. representatives in Azerbaijan in the 1990s and all of these types of dealings that have gone on. And as she says, as she stresses, this is not alliance of convenience. This is not, trying to puppeteer him. This is literally giving these terrorists orders and them carrying out the attacks. And this is just, again, some explosive information. So I wholeheartedly
hope
people check it out.
It's a step up even from what we know, how we funded and trained and helped the Mujahideen in Afghanistan in the 80s under Zbigniew Brzezinski and the usual suspects. This is even a step up from that. And how does it apply to the United States of America? Because I see violence being used to, there was this Bank of America thing in Oakland. They put a guy in there. I don't know if you saw this story. The FBI entrapped a guy to go there and blow this up with his whole plan that he was going to create some kind of a sectarian violence with the extreme right wing against the extreme left wing that, of course, the government can come in and fix. But this was all a plot by the FBI. And it looks like this has come home. The chickens have come home to roost, as they say, Gladio B or C, right here in our own country. So it is, it's pretty important to understand it.
It is. And I would say that there's, I mean, as an operational stratagem, there's a difference between the actual operation. And Sybil has been clear to point out that there is an actual office in the Pentagon that actually deals with these Gladio B operations in Central Asia and the Caucasus region. This is not some sort of abstract idea or plan or something. These are actual offices that are running these types of operations. So that we should differentiate between the general stratagem, which is, of course, this divide and conquer and the funding the terrorists and all of that, from the actual operations that are being committed in these particular areas. But absolutely, I think it is a broader idea that has been applied in many other contexts as well.
Y'all also got into how a lot of the roads are leading to Chicago, and that isn't anything new.
Because no. Yeah, so mobsters in Chicago? No, never.
Well, yeah, right. I mean, you know, the massive corruption, but, you know, with the Chicago University, you see, you know, the Milton Friedmans coming out of there. You see the neocons coming out of there. And so I guess it isn't just because Obama's from Chicago or Rahm Emanuel.
No, but maybe the other way around. Maybe Obama's from Chicago because that's the cesspool that breeds that type of political corruption that gets people into the White House. And I'm kind of interested in that angle of it, and I hope we get into it more in some of our future discussions. But yes, all roads seem to keep coming back to Chicago and some of the players there. You have terrorists that keep ending up coming to Chicago and basically living there while they're wanted by Interpol, and all of these crazy coincidences that always seem to end up back in Chicago. So there's definitely some severe corruption, I guess we could call it. I don't even like to use that word because it tends to downplay what it really is, which is institutional, an institutional system that is set up to be that way. It's not corrupted. It's working perfectly fine. But yeah, it does seem to come back to Chicago time and again. So there's a lot of different connections there. And the best part is that this week, in fact, in our conversation, we're going to be taking questions from the audience. So I've already got dozens of questions to put to her. And anyone else out there who has some questions about what we've been talking about, I'm happy to relay them to her.
How do they get those to you? They go to the website and there's a place.
Yeah, they can just contact me. I have a contact form on CorbettReport.com. Just shoot out an email through that and I'll put it to her.
CorbettReport.com. I want to end up on Cyber Boogeyman and FISA and Echelon. But before I do, you did talk last month when you were on with us about this escalating war of words anyway with North Korea. Now we're starting to get this propaganda coming over here. We don't have to be afraid of North Korea technically because they don't have the capability to really hurt us, but we do need to understand that they think that they're about to be attacked, which makes them very dangerous, and something must be done. Well, of course, they think they might be attacked because there's been all these war games with South Korea and the United States just, you know, off their shorelines here. So it would make you a little bit nervous, I assume. But I think that the picture that's being painted here is that they're madmen, they're crazy. This is like the Iranian thing. They believe the end of the world is coming and they're going to be the you know, the ones that usher that in. This is some kind of religious craziness, as if we're one to talk. And that's why we have to be afraid, because they're irrational. We can't reason with them. And they think that the end of the world is coming. This is what we're getting over here on top of what a big threat they could be eventually and why something must be done about North Korea. So update us from last month as far as what you're hearing on that side of the world in Eurasia and Asia, Asia Pacific, and what I guess we should be saying to our loved ones, to people we talk to when talking about North Korea.
Well, you're exactly right that technically it's ridiculous to even talk about them as a nuclear threat at all. Their nuclear firecracker that they set off was apparently between 6 and 7 kilotons, which is about one half of Little Boy. So it's nothing. I mean, technologically, they're still at a very, very crude state. Although it is yet to be determined whether it was a plutonium device like the other ones they've set off, or whether it was enriched uranium. If it's enriched uranium, that means that they would have easier access to building up their stockpile, basically. If it's plutonium, they're still limited to about six devices. They only had that much plutonium before they scrapped their program there. So So that's the situation they are in. Technologically, I mean, they're not a threat to anyone at this point. Although I guess you could say they're developing and it's slightly bigger than their last tests. Therefore, you know, just imagine what they can do in 20 years. But
on our end, too.
Right.
We're developing all these new weapons and they can't have them. And you could see why, again, I mean, that's why I always stick up for North Korea. It's like, if I'm surrounded by all these people that are looking at me and giving me the look, you know, I want to defend I see how much more power I have since I have a little bit of nuclear weaponry than when I didn't. And I see what happens to places like Iran, or I see what happens to places like Mali or Libya, who don't have these nuclear weapons. So you can't really blame them for trying to get in the game here, so to speak. But go ahead. I didn't mean to cut you off.
Well, I would say I stick with the stick up for the North Korean people, but I do not in any way stick up for the North Korean government, right, which is just as much of a, in fact, perhaps even more so, a disgusting dictatorship by a pot-bellied dictator that I wouldn't be caught dead with. I mean, absolutely not. And I think that they're, to a large extent, I hate the way that a lot of leaders around the world are portrayed as crazy madmen, because it suits the narrative that they want to portray, that these people are demonizable and thus bombable, basically. But I think it probably fits the government of North Korea more aptly than it does any other place on the planet, especially the ridiculous propaganda that they try to feed to their people about Kim Jong-il, and, you know, he invented the hamburger and has the world's best golf score of, you know, 27 or something like that. And just the ridiculous things they invent to mythologize, and basically, I mean, literally their head of state is a corpse. That is the only nation on the planet that has a dead person as their actual president.
Well, and I wonder how much all that is true and how much of that is propaganda, as we hear. I mean, look, there we go back in history and we look at, you know, for instance, somebody like Nero, right? This is bred into us. He was a madman. He was crazy. He tried to make his horse, right? Is it Nero or Caligula? Sometimes I get those mixed up. But he tried to make his horse a senator. But really what he was doing is he hated the rich. He hated these elites, these snobby elite senators in Rome. And he constantly took every opportunity to embarrass them. You know, and in a way, when you kind of look at the real history as opposed to what we're taught, that he was just a madman, he was just crazy, he fiddled why Rome burned and your false flags and all of this. Yeah, there is some truth in the middle there, but I wonder how crazy these Kim Jong-uns of the world really are. I don't think he has any power. I think the military, the guard there is running everything. I don't think
has. Yeah, 100% agreed. Absolutely. I think the power is behind the throne. But the point is that the government, I mean, however you want to define that, is, I don't think they actually believe that Kim Jong-il was some god that was born on a mountaintop. But that's the kind of crap that they actually teach the people. And I'm always surprised by people trying to stick up for the North Korean government. I have absolutely nothing good to say about them. Sure. It's the people that suffer, the people who literally are starving to death in North Korea because they spend, I mean, ridiculous amounts of money to do the mass games and things like this, which is where a lot of their food aid and the other aid that they actually get ultimately goes. It goes to put on the pomp and ceremony to make people believe it.
You hear.
Exactly. Exactly right. And exactly right. So I condemn.
You would be in Asia or something and looking at some of the things that we get our people to try to believe. You know, Obama killed Bin Laden with his bare hands. And, you know, just the stuff that they really kind of hint at or put out there. It's pretty crazy, too.
Exactly right. It's disgusting. It's disgusting to me no matter what government it's coming from. So absolutely, I'm against the government. I'm for the people. And the way to help the people isn't to participate in this farce that they're doing right now with the, I mean, all that's going on right now is an excuse for everybody to step up to the plate and arm themselves even more. I mean, that's what this is ultimately about. This is why every single person in the region is really enjoying this. They're playing up to it. And this is a perfect situation for them. Contrast that to what's happening with Iran right now. In fact, tomorrow in Almaty, Kazakhstan, they are going to start the next round of P5+1 talks. And there's all sorts of hypocrisy going on there, surprise, surprise. But one of them that's coming up is the IAEA. Just last week, just conveniently, nice timing, they came out with a new report. Oh my God, Iran is trying to replace their 1970s technology centrifuges with some newer centrifuges. Oh, this is a worrying development. Although, in the same IAEA report, they actually say that they do not have any evidence that they've diverted any nuclear materials to any weapons program. But of course, what are they focusing on? Ooh, new centrifuges that could potentially theoretically be used for weapons, but they could also be used for a peaceful energy program. So this is the type of crap that's being fed on that side of the world. And it's interesting to contrast the situation that's, I mean, Iran and North Korea has been this paired couple for the last decade in terms of doing very similar things or doing actually quite different things, but being portrayed in opposite ways. And it's, again, it's just the it's ridiculous to look at from the outside, the way that the propaganda skews 180 degrees, depending which side of the divide that you're on.
I still think there's going to be some diplomatic solution that Obama's going to take credit for. I can even see this building in his diatribes here, and even coming from Iran. And then people say, well, you know, what about Israel? See, that's part of the game that gets played. In fact, Obama's actually getting a medal, I think, as we speak, as some heroic medal from the government of Israel this week. So much for they don't get along with Israel. They seem to get along perfectly, though there is this perimeter play, perimeter acting going on that James and I are trying to cut through. Let me go back to North Korea, and I want to find out what you think is going to happen next. You know, a lot of people say this is kind of the perfect excuse for a false flag to be blamed on North Korea. You know, you remember that this whole Red Dawn remake movie came out. It was supposed to be China attacking us, and they made them pull all the references to China and put in references of North Korea. So there's more than just, you know, creating this economic and military battleground in Asia, because Oceania is always at war with Eurasia. You remember 1984? So there's that. But now today we hear there's the first female South Korean president has been elected, Park Geun-hye. What is she up against? I mean, what is the next thing that happens in North Korea? If you can look into your James Corbett crystal ball, and before the next month when you come on, what do you see? Is it as dangerous as they say? Could this be used for a false flag, or is this just all typical business as usual in geopolitics?
I think North Korea is probably the hardest place to look into the crystal ball, because, I mean, I don't think many people would have been predicting another nuclear test at the beginning or at the end of last year. I don't think that was really on the horizon, but suddenly now all of a sudden this is back on the table. It's just such an unpredictable thing. But in terms of any sort of threat whatsoever, even a false flag threat, I'm not buying it. I mean, the idea of a Red Dawn invasion by North Korea of the United States, I mean, the reason that that was put in the movie is because it's so ridiculous that no one would believe it. I mean, it's so...
That doesn't have to happen. It could be, you know, a bomb blows up at a shopping mall, or it could be anything, you know?
I truly don't see that on the plate. I don't see that anytime in the near future. Hey, I could be completely 100% wrong, but I think that's just so far from the realm of the feasible that it's almost ridiculous to contemplate. But again, they've been known for staging things that are ridiculous to contemplate, so I guess I shouldn't put it past them.
South Korea is so concerned, they had the Gangnam Style guy performing at the presidential inauguration of this new woman in South Korea. They don't seem that worried. Maybe we shouldn't be as worried as well. This could just all be business as usual. Let's get into cyber boogeymen. The president, the alleged president, cousin Barry Obama, he was also saying in his State of the Union speech, James, that people shouldn't receive some kind of a gift because of what their bloodline is, that he wants to level the playing field, yet he's cousins and related to kings and queens of Europe, but he doesn't think that should be, you know, going on for the rest of us. I thought that was really lip service, but he mentioned that today at his State of the Union, I call it the STFU speech, that he had issued a new executive order to basically initiate CISPA, which was defeated by the people and in the halls of Congress here last year. And just right on cue, it's almost like the next day, there are major cyber attacks against defense contractors and the State Department by anonymous, and they say China. I reminded my listeners that when I was hacked by China, I was simultaneously hacked by Halliburton. So there you go. There's your boogeyman here. And I think it's the most underplayed story, as I think I talked about on your show. It is the most underplayed story out there. What is going to happen with cybersecurity? What is the internet going to look like next year or the year after that with all of these new rules and laws allegedly being debated?
Well, I guess it's the question of whether it's going to be the incremental slide into a sort of ultimately totally clamped down and controlled internet, or whether it's going to happen in the wake of some big disastrous, you know, cyber false flag. And I think that the specter of the latter is just too much for them to probably pass up. I think we're going to see some sort of event at some point, and we already know they have the iPatriot Act legislation sitting on the shelves. This was what Richard Clark was telling Lawrence Lessig back several years ago, and he talked about that. Richard Clark was talking about, yeah, we have Cyber Patriot Act all lined up, ready for whatever happens. So again, even if it isn't a false flag, even if it was some sort of genuine event, they already have the legislation. And I think basically the vision of the internet that we're looking at for the future is what we're seeing right now on YouTube, on Twitter, on Facebook. They can censor individual posts based on keywords, based on geographic locations. They can censor certain people from joining their sites. They can ban certain people. They can make it look like an open platform if you're there to talk about, you know, cats or, you know, whatever, whatever fluff is going around the internet, that's fine. But, it, you know, to clamp down on political dissent. And of course, that's going to also be hardwired into the technology itself as they start to get rid of personal hard drives. You don't need that anymore because you've got the cloud coming in. And eventually you'll have to use your fingerprint to sign on to the internet. So they're getting the complete control grid in place. It's really only a question of whether it takes 20 years to get there or 2 years.
Mm. Isn't it the truth that you build a smarter mousetrap, you just get a smarter mouse? This isn't going to stop China, if that's the enemy, or Al Qaeda, or the Russian mafia, or whoever we're afraid of in the cyber world here, or Anonymous. There's always a way around it.
Yeah, I don't think ultimately it's supposed to stop everyone. In fact, that wouldn't even be to the benefit of the system. Every right. system has to have those little
But that's why we're giving
doors.
Up our rights, James. They're telling us, give up your rights so we can protect you. Here we are again, right back at square one, but now it's your cyber free speech. Could the Supreme Court, because I know Obama was talking about putting anti-gun executive order out, and most people said that's not going to fly. The Supreme Court's not going to approve it. They'll shoot it down. Don't even bother. But this apparently he feels pretty confident about. And I don't see the Supreme Court, the men in black robes, the Opus Dei Supreme Court, I don't see them doing anything about this. This is a way to circumnavigate the branches of government and the people themselves. This is what a dictator does.
Well, that's right. And of course, we've been seeing this process taking place over decades, but it's really amplified in Bush and now in Obama. And it's really circumventing Congress in every possible way. But I think, I mean, once you get to the point where you're participating in the invasion of Libya without even so much as asking Congress for the rubber stamp, I mean, tyranny is here. That's what tyranny is. This is what it looks like. I don't know what else people are waiting for. You are already living in an executive dictatorship. So welcome. If you're just finding this out, welcome.
He loves us, and it's for our safety. And by the way, the true hardcore Obama supporters here in this country, they're for it all. They'll go for anything to shut up the right wing, the evil right wing who hate women and who are all rich white guys, apparently.
I got another email from a listener out there asking if I'm a neocon the other day, coming right off the back of someone accusing me of being a communist. So I must be doing something right if I'm pissing everyone off.
Well, and I know I only had you for the hour. Stay a few more minutes with me and discuss what you and Annie Michon were getting into with the FISA and Echelon Panopticon. Because, again, this goes into this CISPA censorship of your free speech, along with the complete and total monitoring and databasing of every little thing you do. It's come a long way since the days of Ronald Reagan. You know, what do we need to know about that? And without scaring, I don't want to scare my audiences, but I think knowledge is power. So what do we need to know about FISA Echelon and its advancements here in the year 2013?
Well, I was talking to Annie because I saw on her website, she's got a blog, anniemichon.ch, where she posted in the early part of January of this year, she posted a little post about the FISA Amendments Act extension. And basically, the FISA court was this Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. It requires a special court to give a rubber stamp kind of warrant for them to be able to hack into people's communications. And this is the type of, I mean, it's famous for being a rubber stamp. I think it's only ever rejected maybe 6 applications in the entire history.
There was a story about 70-80% of the time, they don't even ask for the warrants.
Yeah.
They just do it. Yeah.
Yeah. And so anyway, the FISA Amendments Act was this whole thing that was, well, now we can't use that system. We don't even want the rubber stamp. We want to, you know, do it without even asking for it. So this is what that was. It was first enacted in the Bush regime, and it just came up for renewal in late December last year. And of course, it got railroaded through, and surprise, surprise, you know, the Senate passed it. But the interesting part that Annie was pointing out was that they don't need this legislation at all, and they haven't for decades because of the Echelon network, because basically the Anglophone world, New Zealand, Canada, Australia, and America and England have had this intelligence sharing agreement for decades, whereby if the U.S. wants to spy on someone in the U.S., they just ask the U.K., GHQ, to spy on them for them and pass the information to them. And they'll do the same for the U.K. or for Australia or for Canada or any of these groups. So they just do it. They pass the information between each other. They circumvent whatever laws they need to, assuming that they even do that much to circumvent the laws. I mean, I'm sure that there's a lot of just outright breaking of the laws that go on behind the scenes anyway. So that was kind of what we were drilling down to. And of course, once you start drilling down to that layer of the onion, you start to come up against the panopticon, this idea that we're being constantly watched.
Is there nothing that they don't watch? You even look at what Facebook does. Once you sign on to Facebook, and, you know, sorry to have to break this to you folks if you don't know this, they get into your computer and they watch everything you do, even when you're not on Facebook. They're gathering intelligence and information. Even that is if you're not volunteering your crimes and debauchery by posting it yourself on Facebook.
Well, I was just talking about this on my New World Next Week program with James Evan Pilato, MeteorMonarchy.com. We do a weekly news show, and we were covering the buses in Portland, Oregon, where James lives right now, is getting a facelift so that they now not only have video cameras, they also have microphones to listen to people's conversations on the buses. They're recording what people talk about now. So we were talking about that and talking about the panopticon sort of aspects of that, and someone in the comments left the message something like, to think that you're not being constantly recorded and having your conversations listened to whenever you're out in public now is just naive. And to me, that was kind of ironic, because that's exactly the point. They want you to know, and that's exactly what they want you to think about. They want you to be scared all the time to talk about anything because you're being listened to. When really the point of it, to my mind, is if you censor yourself, if you stop talking about things because you fear being watched, they've won. That's it. I mean, that's all they want is for people to stop.
We used to say with Carnivore Echelon or these programs that would look at these keywords you were saying on your telephone, we used to say, well, they can't get us all. I mean, you know, why should we even worry about it? That stuff is so buried in a computer somewhere. But now they have Trapwire, they have Total Recall. They have dossiers on most Americans. They're rating Americans. Are you a good machine, a bad machine? And then you'll get rewards if you're the good machine. And it's so much easier now to keep track of and to look and to pull up people who you don't like and who are being, aggressively detailed in their attacks on the government, at least verbally. So, I mean, you can really find your enemies. You can really punish your enemies. You can rate people on should they be on a no work list, should they be on a no vote list or a no gun list or a no fly list. And this is kind of this separation that we're seeing now. And then we're talking about law-abiding citizens. So now, maybe not before, James, but now law-abiding citizens have to be a little concerned that they could be punished for what they say and do. And it may not be that you go to jail. It may be that you just don't get that job, that you come up on some, you know, database when you're trying to get a job in this terrible economy. And then this, I'll get you out on this one. I find this completely appalling. We did warn our listeners about this for years. New York City to round up mentally ill before they commit crimes. Well, that's already been happening. And there is no trial, James. They come, you know, we've heard the men in white coats or whatever. They come, they get you. And that's it. And you don't tell anybody. You don't get a phone call. You don't get a day in court. They put you in a straitjacket in a professional or a private institution. They start drugging you up immediately. And good luck getting out of there and clearing your name.
Well, unfortunately so. I mean, what is the only answer to this is for us to start detaching ourselves from this system, because the more we play into it and the more we are part of this entire structure, the more that we basically give it our lifeblood. I mean, our blood is the blood of this system, and we have to start really detaching ourselves from it. And unfortunately, that's a long, hard, painful process that has to be fought every inch of the way to a population that's just become so ensconced in this that they can't imagine being without their iPhone or their iDevice or their, you know, 24/7 cable TV or whatever it is. They can't imagine being detached from this. And it's going to be a long, hard, generational struggle at best to really start to wean ourselves off the system that's enslaving us, assuming that's what we really want.
We fought the Cold War for freedom. We fought against the communist Soviet Union for freedom. Yet we're doing the same things that Stalin did. Abraham Shiffrin's book, The First Guide to Prisons and Concentration Camps in the Soviet Union, talks about doing exactly what's happening in New York and all over the country right now. Locking up people whose political viewpoints are dangerous to the establishment and calling them crazy.
Well, it was wrong when they did it, but we're doing it for the right reasons. So
yeah, that's right. Obama's he's not Stalin at all. He's a good guy. He's not Hitler. Don't say he is, or the Obama bots will be very upset with you, and you'll get a visit by some micro drones or something. James Corbett, the Corbett Report. He's so great to talk to. I could go on forever, but it's getting late in Japan. Anything else you want to throw on the record? I do want to suggest that my listeners, as we ask you to do here, support with a minor monthly donation. If you're using the Corbett Report, you're getting a lot of value. You have to support this non-commercial, open source, great, valuable resource at the Corbett Report. So, you know, $5-$10 a month, whatever you can do. That's all we ask. James, if I got $5 a month from everybody who downloaded my podcast, my show every day, we would not only be growing and getting bigger and having better equipment and doing a better show, but I wouldn't have to freak out every month that I can't pay my bills. So yeah. Please support. You know, you have the option. It's free, but you can support the things and vote with your dollars for the things that you love. And I love the Corbett Report. Anything else you want to throw on the record, brother?
Well, thank you for pointing that out to people. I don't like to dwell on that, but I do live in a one-bedroom apartment here in Japan with my wife, and we're about to have a baby, so I don't know how on earth I'm going to continue doing podcasting and things like that. So I'm hoping, maybe, and who knows, we might be able to get some sort of bigger space or some place I can have a studio or something, but I don't know, that's still a long ways off. So and every single contribution I truly do appreciate. Other than that, I'd just like to tell people about a sort of new addition to my podcast series I'm doing. Once a month, I'm also doing a kind of book review / movie review thing called Film Literature in the New World Order, where we're talking about different books and movies and pieces of pop culture and how that relates into all of this. And it's kind of an interesting thing. It's getting a lot of attention. So people should check into that. Next month, we're going to be talking about The Secret Agent by Joseph Conrad. An interesting little book and all sorts of little nuggets in there about the way false flag terrorism really works. So I hope people will stay tuned for that.
As a total bibliophile myself, I really appreciate whatever efforts you do to get people reading books, talking about books.
Well, we're going to have to have you on sometime to talk about one of your favorite books.
Oh, man, I'd go nuts doing that. The Corbett Report, that's with two T's. You can easily find it. Open source intelligence news at CorbettReport.com. There he goes, James Corbett. Great job, James. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you. Talk to you next month.